17th of September contact on his Twitter feed. You can watch it by following the link that appears in the text version of this week's newscast at arnewsline.org. I'm Jeremy Boot, G4NJH.
In the world of DX,
you're listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM.
Tune in all sorts of creative community voices on the radio at WGXC on Monday, September 26th, including at 9 a.m. on the WGXC Morning Show. Rob Gellis speaks with Georgette Turner about the famous painters who lived in Columbia County during the 19th century. And hop on the Afrosonic Taxi at 10 a.m. tracks from Salif Keita, Essence Kazooie, and Angelique Kidjo, among others. At 11 a.m., Brendan Donegan is playing favorites with the Talking Heads live from the WGXC Hudson studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church on Warren Street. And it's time for the Deep Three show after the local news at noon with music from Abby Lee T, Christine Webster, and Aphex Twin. There's new music from around the world at 2 p.m. on the Vital Weekly show, including tracks from Tomotsuga Nakamura, Vertonin, and Tetsue Akiyama. Tracking the Odds at 3 p.m. features the work of jazz drummer Susie Abera. At 4 p.m., the WGXC afternoon show is live from Western Massachusetts with host Kieran Riley. At 6 p.m., the All Together Now show features an interview with Reef Larson about... He's the founder of the Future of Small Cities Institute, and they've got a program Tuesday talking about the Hudson waterfront in Hudson and Beacon and Kingston. At 7 p.m., it's time for the Law and Disorder show, and then at 8 p.m., Rob Van Erve hosts Everything All the Time on 90.7 FM, WGXC. On Saturday, October 22nd, come out to Wave Farm and view the installations. It's part of WGXC's Fall Pledge Drive. Noon to 6 p.m. on Saturday, October 22nd, Wave Farm will welcome drop-in visitors for tours of the campus, including the WGXC Acre Studio and the many installations on the property that employ radio in some way. Also, community members and local nonprofit organizations can come by to record public service announcements to air on 90.7 FM, and members of the public can record a station ID for WGXC. Again, that's Wave Farm is open for visits on Saturday, October 22nd during the WGXC Fall Pledge Drive from noon to 6 p.m. Go to WGXC.org for more information, and we'll see you on Saturday, October 22nd at Wave Farm.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at WGXC.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Oak Pizzeria Napolitana in Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
You are tuned to 90.7 FM, WGXC, hands-on, listener-supported radio for Greene and Columbia counties.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about any of these stories. Liz Montgomery is reporting for Porcupine Soup that a New York State Supreme Court judge has ordered a tire dump on State Route 81 to be shut down. But as of September 19th, 6 days after the deadline set by the court for all tires to be removed, tires still cover portions of the property. On August 30th, Justice Richard Mott signed an order against Green Tire Recycling, permanently prohibiting them from operating a tire dump business at 1113 and 1131 State Route 81 in Climax. The dump contains thousands of tires, and according to the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, does not have a permit to operate despite its ongoing operation since 2020. Mott's made his ruling after the town of Coxsackie took steps to close the dump, contending the facility is in violation of New York State Property Maintenance Code, New York State Fire Code, Coxsackie Town Code, and Coxsackie Town Zoning Law. Property owners Corey Mergendahl, Sharon Lampman, and Shane Foster had until July 29th to respond to the complaint, but none of them appeared or submitted a response. The trio also failed to respond to notices of violation from the town of Coxsackie that were sent this spring. Their inaction ultimately led to the town taking the matter to the state Supreme Court. The town will next seek court-ordered sanctions, specifically allowing the town of Coxsackie and or the DEC to remove the tires, refuse, junk, and garbage, then adding the cost of that cleanup to the property tax bill owed to Greene County. Read more about this story at porcupinesoup.com. The Daily Freeman is reporting that Bard College announced last week it has received $3.2 million to permanently endow the Keith Haring Fellowship in Art and Activism, an annual faculty position within the Center for Curatorial Studies graduate program and the undergraduate Human Rights program. The endowment is made possible by a grant of $800,000 from the Keith Haring Foundation and matching funds from the Mariel Use Hessel Foundation and benefactor George Soros, the college said. First launched in 2014, the fellowship embodies the shared commitment of Bard and the Keith Haring Foundation, and it, quote, also speaks to the historic relationship between the college and Keith Haring, which is further honored with CCS Bard's permanent reinstallation of a wall drawing the artist created in an act of spontaneity while visiting the campus in 1981, unquote. In conjunction with the gift and reinstallation, Bard announced that writer Haytham L. Wardney has been named the 2022-2023 recipient of the Keith Haring Fellowship. L. Wardney will be in residence on campus during the spring semester to teach and conduct research. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. And Barbara Reyna reports for the Times Union that Pearling resident Eric Morabito, the so-called walking man, began his ninth annual 220-mile walk for children on September 16th from his home in Greene County. Walking up Route 32, his 9-day trek takes him through Glenmont, New Lebanon, and into Massachusetts, bringing him to Boston by September 24th. Quote, I start out the first day with 35 miles, 3 days of 30, then 20, and the last 2 days walking 11 and 12 miles, taking it easy at the end, unquote, he said. This year, Morabito is raising money for the Shriners Hospital for Children in Springfield, Boston, Philadelphia, and Erie, the Ronald McDonald House of the Capital Region, and the Cypress Shriners Transportation Fund. He is dedicating the walk this year to Christopher, a teenager from the Catskills who was severely burned as an infant. Christopher has had more than 14 surgeries to date, some at Shriners Children's Boston. He also has been a patient at Albany Med for a neurological issue and stayed at the local Ronald McDonald House. Morabito took his first walk in 2014 with the support of the Shriners. Quote, it was supposed to be a one and done, unquote, he said. Quote, after I did it the first time, I didn't even know if I'd survive. That's why I dubbed it Springfield or Bust. One of my lodge brothers said, quote, next year we'll do better, unquote. So I thought I'll try it again next year, and here I am 9 years later still going at it, unquote. Morabito started his walking regimen for health reasons, and now at 59, his personal health improvement plan has evolved into one that helps others. Morabito is already planning next year's walk, his 10th, which he said will be his last. Quote, I'd like to do the walk 10 times with the goal of raising a total of $100,000, unquote. He has raised just under $68,000 so far. Read the full story in the Times Union. And go to the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org for more information about any of these stories. I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast. And we start each Renewable Weather Forecast off with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. The lowest price, according to the Gas Buddy website, is at the Mobile in Caro, $3.63 a gallon. And we look at the air quality forecast, and it's a 15, very good on Sunday. The UV index on Sunday is a 3. That's also in the moderate range. National Weather Service in Albany says there's a 70% chance of rain on Sunday, possibly a thunderstorm after 2 p.m. with cloudy skies, a high near 65, and a light south wind increasing to 5 to 9 miles per hour, spinning local windmills. Sunday night, again, a 60% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm. Cloudy skies, low around 52, and a southwest wind 3 to 7 miles per hour. Monday, there's a 50% chance of rain, mainly after 8 a.m. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high of 65 and a south wind 6 to 11 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 21 miles per hour for those windmills. Monday night, the forecast is for partly cloudy skies with a low around 48 and a south wind around 9 miles per hour. And Tuesday, there's a 40% chance of rain, mainly after 2 p.m. Other than that, it'll be sunny with a high of 62 and a low around 46. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
We are now joined by Maggie Hazen. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yep, that's correct.
From the Columbia Collective, who has a show up at Foreland in Catskill through this weekend. It ends September 25th, so you still have a chance to see Talking Back, artist of the Columbia Collective. And I guess, Maggie, can you start by explaining to listeners what the Columbia Collective is?
Yeah, the Columbia Collective is, first off, I'm an artist, and so the group that I formed called the Columbia Collective is a group of artists, but who are young and incarcerated at the Brookwood Secure Center in Claverack, New York, near Hudson. It's called the Columbia Collective because they were first incarcerated at the Columbia Secure Center for Girls, and then were moved to Brookwood right next door, which is the boys' facility, when Columbia Secure Center shut down in last August. So we call it Columbia Collective because that's where it started. And right now we are a collective of like three artists who are between the ages of 16 and 20. And then there are a few who have left the facility who've been in contact with me who are also members of the collective as well, who were once incarcerated at Columbia.
And WGXC did a program with incarcerated youth before the pandemic. And so we know exactly how difficult it is to do anything, but why don't you explain to listeners how difficult it is to the bureaucracy, the rules are all very, very strict, and it's almost impossible to do the sort of thing that you're doing.
Yeah, it is extremely difficult. The two things that I've learned from working with them since 2019 is persistence and being consistent. Like, that's really what it takes. Because the system, you know, working with the administrative stuff is just so hard. I mean, there's a key for every door. Every, incarcerated person has to, like, have a staff with them to go into different rooms. And so, like, the administrative staff is always over their heads, the people that are in over their heads with how much stuff is on their plate. And so it's just me sending a lot of emails, me showing up, being turned away. But yeah, the logistics of all of navigating the facility is, I actually find quite fascinating, because I kind of approach it as like a generative principle in some way. Like, those constraints kind of help, they direct my path. They kind of give me the limitations of what I can and can't do. And so similar, like, so I'm not allowed to share the names of the artists that I work with at the facility or their faces. So we use that as generative. So every artist in the collective has a fake name or a pen name they go by. We have Jay, Just A, and Marshmallow, and all of them have a very unique style and identity. They brand themselves with their own logo, and we feature that on the website, as well as their, like, galleries of their artwork. So that's sort of, like, ways we're trying to, like, work around the rules of the system.
And did you bring in art supplies, and was that a difficult process?
Yeah, so I'm able to bring in quite a few art supplies. I have to write a gate clearance for everything, so every little item I bring in, I have to take note of. And yeah, there's, you know, things that I'm not allowed to bring in, but the wing that I work on, they're pretty, a little bit more relaxed, even though it is a maximum secure facility. So, but there's things I can't bring in, like pens, for instance. And so I've had to bring in like soft tip markers or things like that.
And how are the participants, are they chosen by the staff there, or do they volunteer, or they, how does that work?
So it sort of just grew organically. I really let it grow organically. It's more of like who's interested. So the artists I work with are girls, and we have a trans artist as well, who were all at the Columbia Secure Center. So I've had relationships with them for anywhere from between like 2 and 3 years. And we, you know, I start out with teaching something, but I don't like this top-down method. I like it to be very collaborative, so I can just kind of work individually and one-on-one. So they're not really chosen. They're sort of, it just happened that the three that I've been working with consistently have been the three that have been at the Secure Center the longest, and they're all just really naturally talented and gifted in the arts already. So I feel like I'm just there to cultivate their voices and help give them a platform.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Some of them had done artwork before?
Yeah, so a lot of them like already enjoyed art making. Two of the artists, Marshmallow and Jay, were already naturally drawing, and I'd been helping them improve, you know, work on their drawing skills and thinking through how to like expand their medium. But Jess A really wasn't confident in a lot of her art making, but soon she grew and discovered like she really loved it and got really into paper mache and really into writing, and a lot of her like, work really like sold opening night at the opening, and she was like, whoa, I never knew I could do this. You know, I never knew I could be an artist. So it all sort of happens organically. No one's really chosen. It's sort of just the numbers that I'm working with on the unit, so everybody gets the opportunity to be a part, and then they can choose to participate or not.
And people say artists often work with what they see, like the impressionists, all these fields, is their art based on their experience in the facility, or do they use their imaginations to create whole other worlds, or is it a combination? You know, what is it like that way?
Yeah, sort of a combination between the two. I think it depends on who the artist is. Like Marshmallow is really into surrealism, and she kind of makes work that escapes her experience of being in the facility, which really they're just all stuck in their same unit with each other 24/7, with, you know, rare trips off the unit, maybe once a day or so, to another classroom. So she's probably not focused on her reality in the way that like the works of Jay and Jess A are. They really make work that's responding to the environment that they're in. And you can kind of see it in their like realistic like reinterpretations of the artwork, like making a clock or making a walkie-talkie, you know, things that, you know, they make there's two of those papier-mâché pieces in the show. And yeah, they're just making work from what observing the reality and like trying to really process it. So everybody sort of has a different way of coping with the working through or working with the trauma that the system, you know, brings to their experiences.
And tell us something about the I'm guessing that, you know, art typically has a transformative nature, and I'm also guessing that these participants don't have a lot of leisure activities other than this program. I mean, they probably do some work in the facility, and but they don't go out to parties, and they don't go to parks and enjoy nature. So was the art transformative? Did you see changes over the course of working with them?
Oh yeah, I definitely like seen them change throughout the course of my time working with them, because yeah, they are not given much. You're exactly right in terms of like they don't get exposed to many people, and so I think a lot of where I've seen some of them transform is their response to the programming. Like they're all kind of nonchalant in their own way, but when it's art time, they're like, oh yeah, art's cool, you know. They kind of downplay it a little bit, but like, you know, that they're talking about it to everyone else when they're not doing anything. So I've seen it, like how it sort of has awakened them. And the fact that people are listening to them and seeing their artwork at the show at Portland in Catskill, like, and people, like, Chronogram has written about it, and Times Union has written about it, and, like, your people can leave notes at the gallery in response to the artwork that they are seeing. And so this feedback to them is super important. I see, like, how, like, it's so validating to be like, oh, my gosh, I'm heard. Somebody's listening to me. Somebody likes my work. I'm good at something. And so it's, like, channeling this in, and, like, really it speaks so loudly to them because they literally are not, yeah, like you said, doing much. So I've seen that transform them. It's, like, through validation and through, like, seeing people listening, so.
They probably have televisions. Do they have those clear radios that are in some of the other prisons? And we get some letters from the Coxsackie prisoners saying they listen to the station. So is it possible they hear this story about themselves?
That's awesome. Wait, what was your question? Sorry.
Do they have radios even? I don't.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, they don't have radios, but they do have a TV that they watch, like, local broadcasting on that is censored. And then there's a
so they can't watch Law and Order.
No, they do actually watch a lot of prison shows. Ironically, it's sort of a feedback loop. but they have an Xbox. There's a lot of video gaming, a lot of Minecraft.
Do they censor the kinds of video games they're allowed to play?
Yeah, I think so, for the most part.
No Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, probably not. It's more like a. Yeah, I haven't looked at their video games they have yet, but I know they play Minecraft. I've seen them play that.
And the show at Foreland, was it just everything they worked on, or did the partway through the program did you say, well, we're going to work on this theme? Or start telling us about the show at Foreland that's called Talking Back, Artists of the Columbia Collective. And it's through this Sunday, right? September 25th?
Yes. It's open through Sunday. Or it's open this weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
So what is the artwork like in there?
Yeah, so the show Talking Back, Artists of the Columbia Collective, is all of their work. Well, is chosen by our curator, Sophia D'Amico, who is a recent graduate from the Bard Curatorial Studies Program. And so I brought her in to also, meet with the artists to know about their work. And so Sophia curated the entire exhibition and wrote two really fantastic essays about the artists and about juvenile incarceration in the Hudson Valley, which anybody can access through our website. It's a free PDF. But, it's artwork that really is just translating their experiences. Some artwork was in there, some isn't. But for the most part, it's just a collection of their works. And then Sophia brought everything together through the theme of Talking Back, which is based off of a bell hooks novel from 1989, I think.
And I know, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. Talking about art is difficult, but can you describe some of the works that people might see if they head to Foreland?
Yeah, you'll see a lot of drawings, a lot of 2D-based mediums, because that's the most accessible thing we can do in the facility. So a lot of charcoal drawings from Jay that were made out of his sketchbook. There are some banners that they worked on digitally with Photoshop, and then I printed them out digitally. And so there's a mixture of things, and there's a lot of really popular papier mâché objects. So those objects are sort of like objects that they've wanted to make, but a lot of them have kind of translated from their experiences in the facility. So we have like a clock, a broom, a radio. There's a bunch, a telephone, stuff that they see in the environment. But a lot of the work, like, it's really image based. We're only able to do, like, paper mache and sculpture, so that's where there's a lot of that. And there's also a reading room in part of the gallery space, too, where visitors can come and pick up a book and read about some other various voices talking about issues within, our carceral system.
And stylistically, you mentioned this work was surreal before. What different styles are they using?
Yeah. So Marshmallow works with a lot of color, really vibrant color. There's a lot of eyeball motifs that pop up in her work, and you get to, like, I think it's sort of like her way of processing her dreams. And she says, like, she has a very lucid imagination. And so she comes up with a lot of interesting visions, she says, at night when she's, like, going to sleep. She has a very active mind. And so I think there's something about the eyeball that she's focused on in her work and her process. And then, like, Jay's work tends to be very, like, very dark. There's a lot that he's working through and processing. And there's a bit, he likes the dark black and white with a little bit of color popping through, you know, to sort of evoke, like, this other emotional state through, you know, the light piercing the darkness.
And I believe I saw that there was a talk as part of the show last week. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, so we had a panel discussion where we invited Mark Longhi, who was an artist who was incarcerated in Philadelphia. I forget what prison, but his artwork was in this MoMA PS1 show in New York City called Marking Time, and an artist in the age of mass incarceration. And he spoke about his drawings and stuff that he did while he was serving time. He's released now and on parole, so he joined us via Zoom. We had Allison Cornyn and Cynthia Boykin from the Incorrigibles Project, which is a project that focuses on the archival histories of the Hudson Training School for Girls, which was sort of a place where, quote, incorrigible young women would go. And so the whole project's about the definition of that name and how we define those, especially young people who are incarcerated, and how those identities stick.
That girls' school, like, that dates back like a century or something, isn't it? Wasn't it?
Yeah. And Ella Fitzgerald was there.
Right. Yeah. There was a play in Chatham, I think, about that a couple years ago. I remember hearing about.
Yes. I think they're also making a movie about it, but I don't know much. So they were in conversations with each other. And then we had an impromptu guest that asked us if they could actually be a part of the panel the day before. His name is Luke, and he works with the Hudson Catskill Housing Coalition. And apparently he was formerly incarcerated at the Brookwood Secure Center. So we had a lot of interesting conversation going on that felt very local. And
he got to actually tell what it's like inside.
Yeah, so he talked, and while he was talking about his time at Brookwood, he has a very activist personality as well, and so it was great to have him on. While he was talking, he was making a rose out of toilet paper, because he said while he was locked up for 3 years, he learned how to, like, use the fine sheets of a single toilet paper sheet to roll up into, like, a rose. And he left that in the gallery for us to see.
So without this program, that's the main medium of art that goes on in prisons, right?
Yeah, sort of like stuff you find around you. Is that what you're...
Yeah. They have very few materials to work with.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I've been lucky that I've been able to bring in like more art supplies probably than an adult maximum secure center. But yeah, we have to use a lot of what's around us. And there's always a fight for paper towels. There's definitely a scarcity there.
And it's hard to quantify this, but what sort of impact do you think this program has on these participants?
Yeah, I mean, it's a range. I mean, I have the sort of testimony of one formerly incarcerated artist. I can say her name because she's out now, is Marilyn, and she contacted me, she got out in 2020 and contacted me a couple months after she was released, and found my email and got in touch with me, and we built a relationship, actually, like a mentorship. And so she said that the program has, like, really helped her a lot, and she is really interested in being an artist animals to try to pursue that. And so I'm currently helping her work on college applications. So I don't know. I think, like, for me, the impact that I really